the Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
All right, you're very welcome back. It is time now to review the Sunday Papers. This afternoon, I'm in the company of freelance sports journalist Kieran O'Rahlig and Cliona O'Connor, athlete development coach. Guys, thanks a million for coming in to join us. Thanks. It is one of those sporting days where a lot of the Sunday Papers is just kind of, it's a lot of reaction. Some weekends there are big governance stories. Some weekends there are a lot of nice fluffy feature pieces for us to delve over. But it is a hell of a lot of rugby and soccer in the papers today. Before I run through the actual headlines as well, we are streaming live at the moment on all of our social platforms, on Twitter, Facebook and YouTube as well. You can also catch us on the Go Loud app or offtheball.com/radio for OTB Sports Radio. To go through the back pages, the headlines this morning, the Sunday Times lead with a picture of Johnny Sexton celebrating one of his tries yesterday. Sexton on song as 7-try Ireland book place in last eight, but Aki sees red. Stormtroopers is the headline they go at, as Peter O'Reilly explains that the latest developments really from the World Cup as the time of going to press, as the Sunday Times say up there, no decision had been made on the game between Japan and Scotland, which as we speak right now, it's heading into the last minute, and Japan, we can safely say, are going through at top of that pool. They're going to be playing South Africa in the quarterfinals, and Ireland will go up against New Zealand because Japan still lead 28 points to 21. So unless Scotland can somehow score 17-odd points, or more than 14 points at least, in the next 60 seconds, that is going to be the final score there. The Sunday Times, or Sunday Independent, I should say, they also lead with a picture of Johnny Sexton after the match, celebrating that win. Steep climb ahead, Schmidt's men at base camp, but facing into sheer ascent. Pretty much going along with the idea that the tournament is really just starting for Ireland after booking their place in the quarterfinals. Next week they will try go where they've never gone before and get beyond a quarterfinal place against New Zealand. And at the top of the page as well, McCarthy exasperated, but opportunity knocks in Geneva, as Dan McDonald says Mick McCarthy cut an exasperated figure as he doubled down on his belief that Ireland had gained a point in Tbilisi rather than dropping two. I don't think that is the opinion of a lot of the writers this afternoon in the papers, but we'll get to the reaction from Tbilisi as well. On the back page of the Mail on Sunday, again, another picture of Johnny Sexton celebrating one of his tries. Two-try hero Sexton pulls the strings as Joe Schmidt's men find their form to book quarter-final spot, roaring into the last eight. And then at the bottom it says, Ireland gear up for Geneva after drab draw. Seamus Coleman has promised the Republic of Ireland will go for it against the Swiss in Geneva on Tuesday, where a win will guarantee qualification for the Euro 2020 finals. On the back page of the Star, it is actually leading with Gareth Southgate and ahead of Bulgaria against England tomorrow evening. We're only human. Gareth backs his Lions after their disappointing defeat against the Czech Republic the other night. But at the top there as well, we are still in with a chance. And that is hinting at both the rugby and the soccer. As it's explained there, Samoa boss Steve Jackson is pledging to help Bundiaki escape with the ban that would end his World Cup. While on the other side, Ireland boss Mick McCarthy refused to be downbeat after Ireland were held to a goalless draw in Georgia yesterday. On the Sunday World next, they lead with the soccer yesterday from Tbilisi, a picture of Aaron Connolly with his head in his hands after one of those late chances for him. It went just wide. Swits in our hands, win in Geneva and we're home and hosed. Mick McCarthy defending his decision to restrict Galway Wonder kid Aaron Connolly to a late cameo as destitute Ireland suffered a Euro 2020 setback in Georgia. And finally as well, for the moment, we have the Sunday Mirror, who lead with both the football and the rugby. Hit, Aki red card for high tackle takes shine off quarterfinal place as Schmidt pleads for leniency. And miss, McCarthy rues wasted chances as his boys in green see Euro 2020 hopes receive a setback. Now, before we actually get into the reaction from the rugby, which I think is what we're going to start with, just to bring you up to date, the IRFU have released a statement this morning. IRFU statement refutes claims made by Sunday Times. So this statement came in from the IRFU this morning. The statement by Stephen Jones in today's edition of the Sunday Times, referring to the Irish Rugby Football Union being vehemently opposed opposed to any rearrangement of the Scotland versus Japan Rugby World Cup fixture is completely false, and the inference within the article that the IRFU made representations to World Rugby on the matter is totally without foundation. The Irish Rugby Football Union calls on Stephen Jones to immediately withdraw his scurrilous and untrue allegation. So that is a fairly robust denial from the Irish IRFU that they were against any possible rearrangement of the Japan and Scotland fixture, which thankfully for everyone has gone ahead, and the full-time whistle has now gone since I started reading out the back page headlines. Japan 28, Scotland 21. Japan through to the World Cup quarterfinals for the first time. Scotland going home and Ireland taking on New Zealand next week in the World Cup quarterfinal. That is going to be next Saturday morning just after 11 o'clock. So, guys, Kieran and Cliona, where are we going to start? The rugby?
Can we start with Japan?
Will we start with Japan? Just how great it is?
Just fabulous, yeah. Mm. They're like barbarians, teams playing under pressure against big teams and beating them. And it's just watching. We didn't really want to be here. I wanted to be watching that match. but that's fabulous. I mean, to pull that off, given that everything that's come on, the amount of pressure that they've been under. A Scotland team that would have gone out with a lot of, you know, in their heads as well, because they were being talked about being let down and allowed to leave the competition without playing that game. And
yeah, there would have been a real chip on the shoulder from the Scots.
Absolutely.
Backs to the wall stuff.
Gregor Townsend,
everyone's out to get us.
Yeah, Gregor Townsend wouldn't have been short of headlines to stick on the wall in that dressing room, and to go out and score the tries the way they did. They just seemed to play with absolutely no pressure on their shoulders, which you're in that realm of development and athlete development and performance under pressure. I mean, the fact that they've been able to do that twice, like, they're not shocks in terms of performance. Results-wise, they might be considered shocks, but performance-wise, they're not shocks at all.
Well, performance so far through the tournament has been fairly consistent. And, you know, people are saying, oh, Scotland wouldn't have been happy if the game didn't go ahead. But from the sense you get from Japan, I don't think they would have been happy either. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? It's a home World Cup for them. They obviously want to play good quality rugby. They've obviously put in a lot of preparation into hitting a consistent high-level performance for this tournament. And you often see the home team at these tournaments underperforming because there is that weight of expectation. They've got more people there watching it, etc.
Mm. England 4 years ago, for example.
You know, they seem to be coping with that and just playing really attacking, free, fast, entertaining rugby. And that's part of the reason I think why we all like them so much.
Because it's
entertaining as well.
Oh yeah, if they were just stumbling past Scotland, it'd be a very different thing. But the style they play with, I mean, just looking at some of the stats here, like 550 metres, 76 carries over the gain line. I mean, what has Joe Schmidt done that in 2 years, maybe? you know, defenders beaten 33 in one game. The offloads are all over the place, like, and they're wonderful to watch. We were just reading a piece there.
It's the pace of the way they go about everything, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the pace and the confidence. We're reading a piece there about, and again, this sometimes can sound great and not turn out to be great, but they had a netball coach from from New Zealand involved for the last year and a half, and he's been working with them on their lower body, so because they're smaller, they have to be faster, they have to be more agile, and he's working on their handling and changing direction. You know, footwork is obviously key, but he's been working mostly on the props, saying they can squat, they're really fast, but can we get them to turn around and pass? And you see that in the first half there, like how much of that play, small, close at hand passes and movement from the props, even not just Matsushima and the rest of the guys in the back, but they've all looked incredibly comfortable. I mean, if Webb Ellis ever did pick up a ball and run with it, he'd probably want to be playing like the Japanese team is this World Cup.
Yeah, and I think it was probably badly needed for World Rugby this week as well, given everything that's gone on with the, you know, robust contingency plans has been the phrase we've heard all week. And, you know, it really seems that they didn't really have much of a contingency plan. But yeah, given the headlines over the last week, it probably was just badly needed. A nice good headline for them that the host nation have got through to the quarterfinal on merit rather than getting through by default and doing so in the style that they've done it.
Well, also the fact there was quite a lot of deaths overnight in Japan as well. I mean, you could see, I was thinking Scotland might come out and do this, but seeing both sides line up beforehand and the minute silence, I mean, it's been easy to kind of forget that human element of things. A lot of the times, if there is a natural disaster like that, it takes another week or two or so before a game can take place, and sport is great for bringing, you know, a nation together. But to have it the very day afterwards, or even the same day for a lot of the country, for them to go out and do that for the nation is fabulous in its own way.
And even on that as well, like, there are a couple of pieces of, you know, journalists that are in Japan at the moment writing about the experiences they had over the last day or two in their various hotels and stuff, and, you know, eyewitness accounts really of what this typhoon was like. There's one here in the Mail on Sunday by Nick Simon, who was reporting from his hotel in Tokyo. The headline, "I could feel my hotel moving and I was on the 62nd floor." And he's kind of going into details. You know, there was footage of roofs being stripped off houses, cars being flipped over, submerged vehicles, violent floods, trapped residents, and reports of the first death 50 miles to the east of Chiba. In Chiba, a reminder that in the eye of the storm, there was more at risk than the integrity of the World Cup. He's saying there was a sign in his hotel which was meant to reassure guests, but one line stood out: "Our hotel was designed to move during strong winds, so you may notice some related noise. Please do not be alarmed, as this is completely normal." It's one of those things that, like, it's trying to reassure you, but it is doing the exact opposite.
Your hotel is supposed to move.
I think
we see that all the time with big sporting events, like, you know, there's with Olympics and all that. There's always the human element around it, and around natural disasters, and we're always stuck in the bubble of the sport and the games and all that type of thing. But any of these massive events always have a knock-on effect on the actual people that live there. And it's, I think, and this is an example of when it's important to remember that, you know, are, you know, what the count now, 25 people?
At least that, and I mean, millions have been moved out, and houses and other infrastructure destroyed. I think Fraser Brown, even one of the players, put up a video on Instagram last night in his hallway, in the creaking, you could see it moving, which must be very disconcerting. But Japan, of all places, is built for that. I think it's, a lot of people have been piling on, and to be honest, I'm not sure, you know, if people are saying that, why didn't you just move it, you know, one day here or there? A lot of great events, big events, get cancelled entirely. And we're talking about, if we're talking about four games, we're talking about four major events here, you know, 60,000. It depends on which stadiums are. Some of them are smaller. But I think a lot of people are being wise after the event. I haven't, and I was in Japan 2 years ago with the Ireland team. And obviously that was a different time of the year. But we were talking about all the preparation and getting ready for it and why it'll be great. I don't remember, and I could be wrong, and I don't know if you two have seen it, but a lot of articles suggesting that there's a huge typhoon risk in October. Did you see any great deal of articles that were saying that a long time out? There's a lot of people now saying, you know, this is perfectly inevitable.
Yeah, I suppose, though, I'm sure a lot of people, it's not really something you're immediately thinking about. No, you know, it's when the, you know, you see there is this big typhoon coming, and I think a lot of people since then have kind of looked into it and gone, well, actually, now did you look a bit, now did you look at it?
Yeah.
There was a fair likelihood that this could have happened.
There was a likelihood, but it's the biggest in 60 years. And I'm going to bring in an article by Clive Woodward in the Mail as well. And he says they do have a typhoon season in Japan, but more often than not, it comes in July and August. Right, straight away, we can take that point. If he's accurate, we're talking about the World Cup starts in September, and it's October now. So that's a lot later. And he says the Japanese Grand Prix has been taking place in this autumn slot since 63 and not lost a race. Tokyo Olympics started 55 years ago this week and encountered no problems. So he says they've been very, very unlucky. There are questions. Sorry, the Olympics is on there next year in July and August. So we have to wonder, you know, what's the thinking there and how much this might impact what the IOC might come out of this and say. There are questions about contingencies. I think they have a contingency for the knockout stages where they can move it 48 hours. But if you're talking about four pool matches in the space of 24 hours, I mean, I read somebody who's an expert in logistics who said, look, this is really impossible. So I don't know. I think it's a lot more complicated than people saying, could you not just move it a day earlier?
Yeah, but I think, like, a lot of the, where the logistic kind of worries and the logistic complications come in is when you're talking about 40 to 50,000 people, you know, coming to a stadium or something like that. If they had laid out, you know, if there is a danger of a typhoon and we are worrying about this, game becomes behind closed doors. I'm not an expert. It just feels to me that that would take a huge amount of logistical pressure out of the equation.
Sure, sure. But I think some of the games, they were talking about moving them and shipping them, you know, a couple of hundred miles away. And I mean, it's gotten to the stage where this sounds almost cartoonish, or maybe like one of those Japanese TV shows. Woodward again says, would it have been possible to have a jumbo jet or even two planes lined up Thursday night or early Friday morning to fly Italy, New Zealand, Scotland, Japan, referees and TMO down to the southwest of the country that has largely escaped the typhoon? I mean, that just sounds fantastical. I think we really need somebody.
I mean, like England were able to find out their match was called off. They were able to hop on a plane and go down there and enjoy a couple of days of, you know, resting up.
But they're just going down on their own. They're not going to somewhere that needs all the TV crews, all the emergency services.
Yeah.
There's a lot involved.
It's probably, firstly comes down to priorities. You know, you're talking about playing the game behind closed doors. So is your priority the spectacle of the sport or actually getting the game played? Mm. And obviously in this scenario, the safety of 50, 60,000 people is going to be really important. If you can manage to play the game and not put those people at risk in terms of encouraging them to travel, that's a plus, obviously. But there is a... It comes back to choice of venue as well for any of these things. If there is a significant chance that there's going to be big issues, whatever the logistical issues are, or if there's a significant chance that it's not going to be the right environment for athletes to perform at their best, we were talking about the marathon being run in the middle of the night and stuff like that, then is it the right choice? So it's about, I suppose, the priority of, are you trying to create the best space for athletes to perform, or an occasion, a sporting occasion? Or the best of both worlds is obviously... Ideal.
We can't have every tournament in London, you know.
Exactly, yeah.
But I mean, Woodward had a point there. I mean, that's something that hasn't been spotted too often about, you know, they've had the Olympics there, they're going to have it next year. Yeah. They've had those tournaments, the Formula One. I mean, and the dates, you know, it looks like the Olympics are under more threat because that July and August is right in the middle of typhoon season. Yeah. So I think it is, you know, the worst typhoon in 60 years. I don't know how much contingency you really want.
Well, I mean, like there was, I think it was Friday evening, I saw a report, I think it was the Telegraph, were saying that one of the contingencies, for example, if Tokyo was unplayable, the game would be moved to Yokohama.
Well, it sounds ridiculous, yeah.
There's 14 miles between the two of them. When you see things like that, it does make you just kind of go, is that enough of a contingency?
Yeah, I'd like to see somebody get in there and, you know, get it an exclusive or a scoop on what the actual thinking was. I also think New Zealand have come out and said they weren't open to moving. So if they weren't open to moving, that has a knock-on effect that you couldn't have moved the other games. So that was a bit of a problem. I think the biggest problem now, we're lucky that this game's been played.
Hugely.
We're blessed that the other two games weren't that important, but there's still a big asterisk around England and New Zealand not playing a week out. So having 2 weeks before their quarterfinals, New Zealand play us. I mean, Christ, do they need another week of not planning, but of rest and recovery? I mean, that Joe Schmidt... you know, was nearly crying about missing one day before, what was it? Was it against Japan? We had a 6 day tournament, they had eight. I mean, this is an extra week New Zealand have, and England, Australia, same thing. Czechia won't be happy.
On the other hand as well, though, I mean, like, look, hypothetical situation. If Ireland go out and beat New Zealand next week, are people going to be saying...
they were undercooked.
New Zealand haven't New Zealand haven't played a match of significance since the opening round of the tournament against South Africa.
Yeah. Well, we're back in confirmation bias land.
That's part of being in a tournament like this, where it's multiple games. You've got to be able to take the rest, take whatever the context is. The best teams are able to deal with it, whether it's 7 or 8 or 14 days, the rest. Mm.
All right, we do have to take a quick break and get you your news and weather as well. We'll be back with some more reaction to the games in Fukuoka and Tbilisi yesterday, and a few more little bits as well besides.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
You're very welcome back. We're here reviewing the Sunday Papers in the company of Kieran O'Reilly and Cliona O'Connor. We have been speaking about, in the opening part of the Sunday Paper review, Japan getting through to the World Cup quarterfinal, and I suppose the knock-on effect of what has been a really difficult week for world rugby and the effects of Typhoon Hijibis. But we'll get on to the actual coverage of Ireland's win against Samoa now from yesterday. And we're going to start, guys, with Neil Francis in the Sunday Independent, page 2. Frustration once again as law puts players in danger of serious injury. Just to pick out a couple of lines, he's speaking about Bundiaki's red card yesterday and how much sympathy he has for Bundiaki. He says, once again, the unfeasibly late directive of the new laws regarding head-high tackles comes in 6 weeks before the tournament. The refereeing fraternity and their guiding committees have again shown that they have virtually no empathy with the game and its players. I suppose, quickly, where do you stand on that?
Well, can I just say his intro first, the first line is just classic. I've always felt that the ideal weight of any member of a rugby committee should be approximately 3 kilos. That includes the urn. Delightfully dark from Frano there. Well, I think he said there, I think he's got a perfect point about the lateness of this directive, that it's coming in so close to the tournament. That shouldn't happen at any level. I mean, I know rugby loves to change new laws and implement new tests and what have you, but to have pulled it in that quickly and that closely, I mean, it's had a massive impact on the tournament. And I think when Conor O'Shea, who quite gracefully took the cancellation of his game against New Zealand, but he was rightly saying anything could happen in this game. They could have had a player sent off. Mm. And we saw what Australia did against New Zealand with 14 men in the Bledisloe Cup just a few weeks ago. Obviously, I don't think Italy would have won if New Zealand had 13 men. But still, the fact that the cards could and may yet have such a big impact. Players don't seem to have gotten totally to grasp with it. I mean, I think a year ago, I mean, you could argue that's always been a red card, and I don't think World Rugby has changed a huge amount in the laws. But, you know, the Aki one, I think it was just a fair call. It was a fair straight red. But what Fran was saying here is that he should never have been sent off in the first place, and that is why we can't help grumble about inconsistency. In the 27th minute of the game, Stander took the ball up to the Samoan line. And then the out half, Sutaini charged into Stander. His leading shoulder hits Stander square in the jaw. Nobody dipped. There were no mitigating circumstances. It was a clear-cut red card. In real time or in slow motion, it was very clear what had happened. And Stander, who was able to take the hits, really felt that one. And there was nothing given there.
Yeah, I don't know. Did you see that one in the match?
Not in real time. Yeah. I didn't know, but I went back and watched it. And I'm not sure.
You're undecided over it.
To be honest, there's a few of them. I mean, even the Stockdale one. I mean, Fran O'Hare says the hit in Stockdale in the sixth minute was the worst of all the head tackles. It is true that Stockdale did dip prior to contact, but that hit could have done serious damage to the Ulster winger. And I mean, I think I do have a problem with decisions being made purely on the outcome. You know, when a player falls high, and if they fall on their head, it's a red card. If they fall on their back, it's not. I think that's a ridiculous law. Mm-hmm. But in this one, I thought that was really dangerous. I think ultimately they're trying to get every defensive player to go lower and lower, but some of them, it just seems unlikely that you could. Jack, I think it was Jack Lamb in the game, said, what else can we do? And the ref said, tackle lower.
Yeah, like, well, I think
it's easy
the,
to say, but...
Yeah, but that's part of it. It's like the... You can't just continue it, you know, in terms of all the evidence around the concussion and the safety of the head and all that. So there is an argument for it's too close to the World Cup to initiate a rule change, that there isn't time for people to get used to it. But I think the essence of what they're trying to do is correct. And it is a new skill for players. I mean, it is, how do you tackle with the force and power that you want in a more specific manner? So it does take a while for people to get used to it. I don't think it's... it takes any of the physicality or anything or that out of rugby or changes that dynamic. But it is a new skill, for sure.
Yeah, and
I think it's tackle better.
I think it's more the actual just step-by-step framework is what was brought in quite close to the World Cup. Because like for the last year or 18 months, they absolutely have been clamping down on you know, tackles that hit the head and stuff like that.
Yeah, but the mitigating factor, that's probably the key thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and what I thought was interesting yesterday, like we had Johnny Murphy in studio with us and Keith Wood was on afterwards as well. For the match, and you know, they were both saying on the yellow card for that Samoa had, that they actually thought that was a yellow and Aki's was a red because of the way the Samoan player actually dipped into the tackle himself, that in the Samoan case, that, you know, he had actually crouched down into quite a low tackling position, which if Stockdale hadn't dropped down, he would have just caught him pretty much right in the middle of the stomach. Whereas I think with Bundy Aki's one, both players were kind of upright. Well, the Samoan player had just fallen down a little, but Aki was quite upright when he made the hit.
He was, yeah. I mean, are we going to start gaming this now a little bit as well? You know, will the carrier drop a little bit? I mean, some of it just seems so minute. And, you know, everybody's saying Bundy didn't mean it. I don't think that ever matters, really. You know, if you have a bad tackle in soccer and you're studs up, intent doesn't count.
Yeah.
But it's going to take a while. I do think, yes, in a way I could argue bringing it in a week before the World Cup shouldn't be any worse because you're trying to get the right thing.
Yeah.
You know, the intent is there to make the game better. But I do think there's been quite a few instances where the TMO even has been brought in and they've talked it through and they didn't get the right decision. I mean, Samoa should have had a couple of red cards. Was it against Russia?
Yeah, and I think the opening weekend, it was the Australian-Fiji game with Rhys Hodge.
His
tackle on Sammy Karevi, I think it was, or one of the Fiji, or not Sammy Karevi, he had a red card against...
mixed up in all these games now.
Exactly, well, there have been so many red cards, you know, seven so far, I think, in the tournament, by a mile, a record for the tournament as well. But
Well, that's a story in itself, isn't it? I mean, that's indicative of the issues we're having here, and I think that's maybe what what Frano's talking about. I mean, in fairness, Neil Francis probably remembers Buck Shelford having, you know, losing three teeth, two concussions and a testicle in one game.
Yeah.
And looking at this game now and going, ah, lads, I'm not too sure about that. And intent, I think a lot of people are still looking at intent and struggling with that. But if it is to change the game and change the habits of everybody for a better sport, you're probably going to have to put up with the pain.
Yeah, I think it was Eddie O'Sullivan on off the ball at some stage. I think it was about a year ago when there were a couple of red cards coming in for these kind of tackles. And I remember him saying at the time, unfortunately, this is just something that we are going to have to put up with.
Yeah.
A lot of inconsistency. Yeah. We're going to have to put up with a lot of decisions that we think might be harsh. But ultimately, in a few years' time, we're going to be looking at the game and it's going to, hopefully, it's going to be a lot safer. Yeah. And you kind of just have to put up with that frustration for a little while.
You do, because it's a new structure, the mitigating factor, and then it's all based on that decision making. So someone has to make the final decision. And until we have sort of benchmarks of what is and what isn't, and we get used to it a little bit more, there will be inconsistency. And I think we just have to grin and bear it for a better outcome eventually, you know. Mm.
Well, it didn't affect Ireland too much yesterday, so it's easier
really
to take, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, if Fardy Savea gets one next week, it'll certainly be interesting. New Zealand don't really get red cards, though, do they?
They don't. When did they get a...
Against Australia.
Yeah, against Australia. Yeah. And that was a huge talking point.
The third time in history or something like that.
Sonny Bill Williams against the Lions was the only one before that for a number of years. You mentioned how it didn't affect the performance too much. Is that where we'll go next? There were a couple of pieces kind of going through the performance. Shane Horgan was one, actually, who...
Shane's probably a little bit of an outlier, because there's a lot of willful optimism, I think. People are digging for optimism. There's a lot of people speaking well of Sexton, Conor Murray, Jordan Larmour, CJ Stander. But Shane just cuts through that, and I'd have to say I'd, on balance, agree with him. He says it's the headline there is it's a struggle to see how this team can topple a joint. In the case of this Ireland team up against the world champions or the Springboks, which it is obviously New Zealand next weekend, I'm struggling to identify that chink of opportunity. He says yesterday's performance was better than the win over Russia, but good enough to beat New Zealand, I can't see it. And I mean, you know, on a one-off game, you know, the cliche, anybody can beat anybody. You could have a red card, which could make a massive difference to that game. But if you balance it all out, the probability for Ireland just doesn't look good, even though yesterday was a great improvement. I think there is a lot to look in. Rory Best looked better than he had. Johnny Sexton, definitely. I'm surprised kind of to see him celebrating two tries against Samoa so strongly, but that maybe tells us something.
Mm.
You know, because he does let himself, he shows his heart in his sleeve on the pitch sometimes for bad, but I think yesterday for good. And I think Larmour played well. I think CJ Stander stepped up. Tyke Byrne might, I don't know if Joe, you know, will go to somebody like him for a quarter.
You get the feeling if it's New Zealand, well, since it is New Zealand, I should say, in a quarter final, that you are edging back towards the more tried and trusted O'Mahony, Rob Kearney, if he's available again.
Yeah, you'd have to think so. And I brought up the ages in front of me here just to be sure about this, but it's Rory Best's last games. Johnny Sexton.
But he's going to play. He's got three more games, doesn't he?
Johnny Sexton is going to go full Tom Brady if he's going to be playing in France in 4 years.
Yeah.
Rob Kearney is almost certainly finishing this World Cup. Sean Cronin's the next oldest. Keith Earls, Keane Healy, Conor Murray's 30, so you know he's a scrum half.
Yeah.
He could have a few more years. But you've got a lot of players there for whom next Saturday could be the last game ever in an Ireland shirt in
at a World Cup. Yeah.
Even a couple of them, you know, I don't know if they'll all continue on.
Well, certainly, as we said, like, you know, Rory Best, he's finished after
he's
this.
He's definitely gone. Yeah.
There could be a couple of test retirements as well afterwards.
Yeah,
as well,
there could be a couple other, even, you know, elsewhere. But you know, that's one thing to hope on.
Mm-hmm.
But in fairness, I don't know how many of Ireland's big wins have been built on raw surge of optimism, of emotion. You know, we're generally.
I think that's where Ireland actually gets their biggest wins. Would be my thinking. Yeah.
Like I don't know. I take Shane's point. You know what we saw the other day. It isn't going to be the All Blacks, but of course it's not. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's sort of an obvious point, because you're now into a quarter final, and yes, the team has been stumbling a little bit through the group stages, but that doesn't mean they can't take a huge amount from that. And maybe because they weren't happy with their first couple of performances, and then they go and they play Samoa, and what did we see? Just back to basics. There was nothing unbelievably great about their performance. But what do you do when you're in trouble as a team? You go, right, let's nail the basic stuff and let's get that right and get that all boxed off and get through the game.
And it's something they haven't been doing.
They haven't. Yeah. They absolutely haven't been doing it. So if you're looking at it over a tournament, you're thinking, okay, well, next game, obviously massive. So first thing, you're not going to beat the All Blacks unless you have all those basic things boxed off. You know, all the things that they're good at. And then you're relying on that little bit piece of magic because it's Rory Best probably last game and all that. So you're relying on all that to come out afterwards. But I think they had to return to basic, simple rugby and try and get that right rather than going, oh, let's go out and produce something magical. Because if you go chasing that, you end
midway through a tournament probably isn't the ideal time to be going doing something like that, really, is it? To rip up the playbook and say, you know what, lads, throw this thing around today, let's see what happens.
Yeah, definitely not. And Joe Smith said at some point as well, you know, we went back to what works for us, you know, and of course they would. Because, right, let's get back to what we as Ireland are good at and get that right first, which I think is what we saw. But that basic performance won't beat the All Blacks. So to that point, Shane is correct, but it's not surprising.
There's one part in it that he says that I find curious enough, because we were talking about how Johnny Sexton looks like he's quite sharp, the sharpest he's been for probably in the last 12 months or so. But Horgan says, I don't expect to see Joey Carberry in the starting lineup, and that pains me. When he came on yesterday, he oozed class. I love the way he avoids contact, not because he has a problem with collisions, but because he is so aware of space and its value. His grubber kick in for Andrew Conway's try was further evidence of his astute rugby brain. He doesn't specifically say that he would want Joey Carberry in ahead of Johnny Sexton,
I think
that's the way I'm reading it.
I think it's one of the great regrets. And again, this is nothing against Rob Kearney, because he's constantly delivered. But looking at what other countries have done, if we could have gotten Joey in there at some time. Now, again, obviously his injuries haven't helped him. He got injured in the very first game against Italy. Maybe he would have played against England or either the games against Wales. He could have played at fullback, could have played at 10. To have seen him get on at 15 would have changed that Ireland team completely. I mean, Larmer's showed a lot of what he has. He's grown into the role. He's gotten more confident. He looked brilliant yesterday and linked up with Sexton for that try. Was what you want from Larmer. And that's something that Rob wouldn't give us either. So that's a reason to think Larmer could do something there. But if you had Joey, I think a lot of coaches would just get Joey on the pitch. You know, they'd like Leinster did, putting Johnny at 10, Joey at 15. He's just got so much magic. And that try was just the same as he did against Gloucester. I mean, with Munster, he linked up. He's looking for it, you know, and not many other Irish players are looking for that kind of thing. And I think the last paragraph of Horgan there was good, because, we are talking about, we're at this stage, we're at the quarterfinal, and none of the problems we had before, none of the issues. Like, who's gone home? Jack Conan? You know, we had a couple of injuries beforehand, but Horgan says, I fear, however, that he, being Joey, will come to symbolise Ireland's missed plight of this World Cup. The injuries that kept him out of the early games and the cautious approach that has refused to countenance even trying to play him and Sexton in the starting 15. And, you know, that might be, you can lose in a World Cup quarterfinal in a million different ways, but there's been a few things that haven't gone well in this tournament, and I think it will be the little kind of incidences that we're talking about rather than the big catastrophe against Argentina last year if things don't go right next week.
Mm-hmm. On the same page on the Sunday Times, pages 2 and 3 there, Stuart Barnes is, he's hammering home the Irish optimism, really. Not even the All Blacks will want to face this giant green monster. The headline is probably a lot more kinder than the contents of it, because he's not really saying we're this outstanding rugby team who could play the All Blacks off the pitch.
He's a great line there, a giant green monster capable of sucking the very air out of a game of rugby.
Which is a compliment of sorts, I'm taking it as. Why any neutral would want this percentage rugby to prevail over the panache of the defending champions is a mystery, other than everyone else's chances will rise if New Zealand lose. So, you know, he's pretty much saying everyone's really going to want Ireland to beat New Zealand next week. Not necessarily because it's some great story, but it means their own chances get a little bit better if New Zealand are gone.
Yeah, I mean, and it is, and he says as well, like, it's a little bit ugly, but it's effective.
Yeah.
So there's that piece, and we see it in all sports. It's like, oh, we don't like it, but if it works, then have you got an obligation to do?
Yeah.
To do.
Like,
that?
I mean, if Ireland were to beat New Zealand next week, would you look back at the stats and go, do you know what? There was way too many rocks in that game.
Yeah. You would not. You'd be jumping.
There was way too many kicks
swinging from the rafters. But it'll be interesting, because when you have a, you know, defensively strong team and a team that plays in that way in terms of the pick and go, versus the All Black style. It's sort of, from a performance point of view, it kind of comes down to that, who's going to execute then? Who's going to be able to impose their style on the game? And usually in those games, you find it's a moment of magic from somebody when you've got that stalemate, or it's an error, a big error or a big moment of magic that can be the differentiating factor.
Well, he did say there, you know, yesterday we saw signs of a perfectly timed return to form from Sexton and Murray. And, you know, we could, I mean, God knows what, you know, the last year of rugby has just been utterly unpredictable from Ireland. And I think I was on here with Michael Swift and Andy Dunn the Saturday before the Scotland game, and we were all kind of saying we don't know what Ireland will turn up tomorrow, you know. But now, you know, we have seen Murray, you know, if we're talking about this being a big documentary of Ireland's World Cup victory in 10 years time, they could look back to the, you know, Scotland, Japan and the Samoa game where Johnny Sexton and Conor Murray just kind of clicked, and they did kind of click. The opposition wasn't great, we had a lot of possession, but some of the kicking from Murray, Earls gathering it, Murray again seeing space in behind, beautiful kick, Sexton playing well, and again that kind of aggression, that reaction from Sexton said a lot to me, because when you see Johnny like that, it's good stuff, you know.
After he scored the try,
yeah,
it reminded me. I was trying to think, even when you said it a few minutes ago, one that I knew there was some try made. France in the Six Nations this year, Sexton went over for a try. It was after the, obviously they'd been beaten by England. They'd gone out, performed quite poorly against Italy, and they would have come in into that game against France. Sexton got a try,
and
there was a real passion in the celebration as well. And ultimately, it obviously didn't work out too well the following week against Wales.
But the story of the year, But when Sexton does that, I think I remember a European Cup game as well where he was in the corner, and was it New Zealand? Well, after Stockdale's, and he ran to the crowd and, you know, did the whole Chris Sutton kind of celebration. You don't see it often, and I think that's good. I think that's good for an insight into the mentality. Tadhg Furlong, you know, celebrating again. What a try that was. And, you know, that gives me an impression that they're enjoying it, and they're enjoying it off the pitch. And maybe they've blocked out a lot of this and they're coming into this game. And they won't be afraid of New Zealand, which is something that we've never said before at the World Cup.
Yeah, but that mood on the pitch is contagious. When you see key players and they're reacting like that, and there is that bit of passion, that bit of motivation, it's really important. And maybe they needed opposition who gave them a little bit more space. They had a little bit more time to make those runs, to time everything right, to reconnect and find that little bit of rhythm again between them.
A belief that they can go out next
week. This is what it feels like, and, you know, just a kind of a warm-up and a build-up.
Do you remember that feeling?
Yeah. Remember this, fellas, yeah.
Right, guys, that's where we'll leave it on the rugby for now. We'll take a quick little break and we'll be back with more from Kieran and Cliona. We'll probably go towards Tbilisi and the Irish soccer team after the break.
Can't wait.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
All right, you're very welcome back to the Sunday Paper Review. I am in the company of... Sorry there, forgot to turn on my microphone. Welcome back to the Sunday Paper Review. We are in the company of Kieran Rahalig and Cliona O'Connor. We've spent pretty much the majority of this so far talking about the rugby. Time, though, to turn our attentions to events in Tbilisi yesterday when the Republic of Ireland drew nil-all with Georgia. The piece that stands out... Kieran, you think anyway. Sunday Independent, Eamon Sweeney, Kenny era just can't come soon enough, is the headline.
Yeah, I think we always look at the articles maybe that might reflect our own views on it, and that's certainly been my thinking. I think I can understand the, you know, the crossover deal between Kenny, between McCarthy and Kenny. I think the FAA didn't want to have that pressure on Kenny to get us to a home tournament, you know, a couple of games in the big tournament. So I can kind of understand it, even where a lot of people don't really understand it that way or wouldn't look at it that way. But he said only an imbecile could have smiled after the tedium in Tbilisi, which is what the DVD will be called when it comes out, I'm sure. Ireland have not been transformed under McCarthy. This was the same kind of creatively impoverished performance which typified the final days of the previous incumbent. And I have to say, I would have rather had a John Delaney scandal today than have to talk about this game, because it was awful. I'd rather have watched New Zealand, Italy, even if they didn't get to run out on the pitch in Japan. It was just terrible.
At least you get to see New Zealand.
Yeah, well, you get to see them train maybe or something like that. But there was a great line, the manager is a kind of a cosplay Jack Charlton, beloved by those who think it's possible to travel back to the days where we could put him under pressure, give it a lash, And I think he called him. Is it in the headline? Oh, it's on the online one. Something about Brexit, was he?
Yeah, I have it here actually highlighted in the middle. Mick is the Brexit manager telling us everything can be the way it used to be before you believe it.
Yeah.
Are we just very harsh because we have Stephen Kenny to compare him to? Is that shining a light? Is that showing us this is what it could look like? If we didn't have
like
that
Jim
comparison.
Bowen going, here's what you could have won.
Yeah. No, are we getting impatient because of that? You know,
I don't think it's helping. I don't think it's helping, Mick. And it's not even just the play. I think it's the reactions. You know, I was there. I watched Kenny take Dundalk. Again, they didn't win a lot of games, but they had some incredible results in Europe and performances, more importantly. And it was how he spoke. And how he was disappointed at losing at home to Zenit St. Petersburg, who had spent millions and millions. I think they had Axel Witsel in that team.
Yeah.
They're 2-1 at home. They were 1-0 up. But Mick comes out yesterday, and I think Tony O'Donoghue asked him, you know, are you happy with the point? And Mick gruffly says, you know, what do you expect me to answer to that? Of course he is. And he was thrilled. And Stephen just wouldn't be, you know. Yeah. And it's not just that. It's the way he intends the team to play. It's the ambition. And you just don't see that with Mick's team. He's very pragmatic, and that can help you in a lot of places with a lot of teams. But at international football, all these draws, like, we need to win one of the last two games, and they don't look very likely either, do they? Mm-hmm.
Out of curiosity as well, actually, like you're saying there, Mick comes out afterwards and says, you know, pleased with the draw, good point on the road. Do you think Mick is actually pleased with the point on the road, or is he just putting on the front, you know what, you know, he might be telling the players it wasn't good enough, but he's going out to say, look, it was a hard-earned point.
I think he seems to have lower expectations. I think you're right about the ambition. You know, he doesn't fill you with enthusiasm. And you hear that, the camp is happier and people get on, it's steady ship. And that's great, but you have to win. Like, this is international football, so it's about winning games. And I think that the fact that... he is presenting that. Let's play as underdogs. Mm-hmm. So if we play, that's what he seems to know. We'll play as underdogs, so we'll defend with heart, and there'll be some great individual defending. But he even admits himself that the lads didn't keep the ball very well in the middle, and, you know, while they didn't get a shot at goal, we weren't great up front. Well, you have to be. You know, that can't be okay then.
The thing that he kept James Collins on was his ability to defend. Dan McDonald talking about pragmatism overtaking positivity, and I think that, like, if Mick was to bring out another biography, that probably should be the name of the book. One of the reasons he kept central striker James Collins on was his ability to defend Georgian set pieces. I mean,
but if you're in a game where this is going to be crucial for our chances to qualify, at some point you have to say, okay, he might be the better defensive man, but we have to score. We have to be a bit more courageous and go for a little bit more.
I'd be curious, in your own role, kind of in coaching, like, would you be against kind of going out telling players like that, you know, on paper, the Republic of Ireland have a better team, they're considerably higher in the world rankings and stuff like that. Does it feel strange to be going out telling a team to sit back and wait for an opportunity and, you know, let the opposition make a mistake?
I definitely think that's a strange way to approach it. If you are the sign of a good team, right? If you're better, you should be able to impose your own game. This idea of the game is chaotic and you can't plan for anything, I think, is a cop out. If my team is playing another team and they're better, my team is better, spectators should be able to sit back and go, that's how they want to play the game. Mm-hmm. You should be able to dictate it. And I think that sometimes with the Irish soccer team, when we play teams that are deemed to be of lower standard than us, we sort of don't impose ourselves because we don't seem to know this is how we're going to play the game, this is how we're going to attack, this is how we're going to score.
There's another quote in there from from Mick in Dan's piece, and this is Mick saying, I always get the feeling, even from the Georgian journalists, that we should be disappointed as we are much better, but I don't get that at all. That's a ridiculous notion. So he thinks the fact that Ireland are better than Georgia is notions.
Yeah.
Like, if this Ireland team was accused of murder, like, we'd get off because we've no fingerprints whatsoever. Like, there's just no thing that you could look at and say, that's great. Like, Vladimir Weiss says Ireland were dangerous with set pieces, which is, the, you know, the soft bigotry of low expectations again.
Yeah.
They play this football, we play another football, we play combinations, as in we pass it.
Yeah.
And I think that's just indicative.
Yeah, and you could see in like the middle third of the pitch, Georgia looked fantastic. They could pass the ball around comfortably.
Yeah.
They didn't really look like they were up to much at the back. They didn't really look like they were up to much once they got within 25 yards of the goal.
I'd say the only people who hate Georgia-Ireland games more than Irish fans are Georgian fans, because they play the best stuff. I was in Mainz years ago. It was cancelled. It wasn't allowed to be played in Germany because of the war. And Trapattoni is in charge. So we went to Mainz, which was a god-awful little place. And they played us off the park that day. And I think we did well in the end, but you were looking at them and wondering, why is it they can just play so much better? I mean, we've scored 6 goals in 6 games in a group that includes Georgia and Gibraltar.
Mm. I thought there was a good line actually.
Very happy.
Even back to Eamon Sweeney's piece, even all the joking aside, which he's often quite good at, he's a very witty writer, but he's talking about how, I think Mick McCarthy had highlighted, you know, Georgia got a point against Denmark at home as well. Denmark struggled there, but Eamon Sweeney just says, the Danes tried to win in Tbilisi, Ireland hung on and hoped to nick something from a set piece.
Yeah.
It's a massive difference between the two games.
Yeah, like, you can lose in different ways, you can win in different ways.
If Ireland had, you know, had dominated Georgia yesterday and for whatever reason they just couldn't get the ball into the back of the net, you'd probably be looking at it going, you know what, maybe it was a couple of points dropped, but you know, there's good signs heading on to Switzerland, the way the team are playing, things like that. But you're looking at this and you're going, you need to get a win against Switzerland and Denmark.
There's one quote
where are you going to get it?
There was one quote there where somebody asked him a question about how Georgia played with freedom, and he responded by asking the inquisitor if he ever played professional football.
Mm.
I mean, when you're dropping to that low standard, I remember having an argument at 2 a.m. with a former Euro 88 hero in Prague many years ago, and I think I was arguing that the defeat to Cyprus that hadn't happened much longer before that was worse than drawing to Liechtenstein. And I said, at least we got a draw there. And he says, oh yeah, how many medals have you won? You know. And I think if you're going down that road,
well, it's
not
highly
in a good
defensive
place,
because you don't have an answer, so you're just relying on that. But I don't know how.
But Mick saying that in a press conference, like, that's not good.
No, it's not. It's you're trying to deflect, I suppose, from the reality of the situation.
Tackle the man, not the ball.
Yeah, studs up from that one.
All the cliches there. There's a lot about Connolly as well. Switzerland, go on, sorry. I'm jumping all over the place there.
No, sorry, I'm just holding my hand there. Yeah, not pointing.
Connolly's been, it's almost one of those Wes stories, isn't it? Like, when you're not playing, you become...
We always have one of them,
30-40%.
We always have one of them.
I mean, it's good that we have one, I suppose.
We had Jack Byrne for a few months, and all of a sudden, everyone's on to Aaron Connolly now.
Yeah. And Troy Parrott was in the middle as well. But Connolly did well when he came on. I don't think it's been harsh, but he should have scored. He had a great chance. He went to the wrong side of the goal. He really should have scored. And if he did, I think we could be getting carried away. Curtis.
It would have papered over cracks, wouldn't it?
Oh, no, it would have been in general. But about him, like, there's a lot of...
That goes in. You just need 1 point from the last 2 matches.
Oh, it changes everything. Mm. Yeah. And, I mean, you know, you can't criticise the lad. It's his debut and it's away from him. But he should have scored.
And he was only on for, what, 13 minutes? Yeah.
But did you see his interview afterwards? His reaction.
Oh, at least
the game.
He had the right reaction, didn't he?
And the interviewer, I can't remember who it was, but was trying to be, oh, your debut in this, and it was, no, I should have scored. I'm a striker. It's my job to put the ball in the net.
Yeah, I like that.
He seems to be very focused. There was no deflecting with him, you know.
He wasn't taking the easy one.
Took
like,
ownership
it was my first day.
Will we knock that expectation out of him over the course of time?
I've seen a couple of clips of him playing underage as well, and he's got that old Damien Duff, you know, the direct aggression, a good cross in. But playing up front there, like, he obviously, his pace is something that we don't really have. And James Collins, I my mother told me not to say anything bad if you don't have anything good to say about somebody. So I won't say anything. But I think we might be getting a little bit carried away with Connolly quite quickly, which is often the case. It's understandable a bit. But I'd have my issues about Mick reacting a bit testily, you know, when people say, will he be in, will he be there? And Mick seems to get ticked off that you're almost telling him how to do his job.
Well, it's exactly what we had towards the end of the Martin O'Neill days, wasn't it? That, you know, people were questioning him about, you know, selection or about performances and stuff, that there was that bite back. And I think a lot of people are talking about how it kind of is going back towards that kind of a time.
But is it a case as well where that kind of flashy, exciting thing that Connolly brought the other night, again, it serves as a comparison to the dreary, can't keep the ball type performances that we see when he's not on the pitch, you know, so it nearly calls out the thing that we're missing all the time.
It shows it up a bit too much for Mick.
I think so.
It's a bit uncomfortable. Who was on the RTE panel? Do you remember?
It was Duff, Kevin Doyle, and
It was Doyle. Yeah, Doyle said, you know, the more you guys call for somebody to come in, the less Mick will want them. It was tongue in cheek, but as somebody who's played at Wolves under Mick, it didn't come across great for the manager.
And I think even on the TV coverage, I think it was Shane McGrath had a decent piece in the Mail, kind of comparing the rugby and the football analysis, and he's kind of saying what frequently distinguishes our soccer on big days is analysis on RTE, whereas too much of the contributions of Jamie Heaslip in particular, but also Stephen Ferris on the Rugby World Cup, seem compromised by the fact that many of the men they're scrutinising were teammates and friends. There's a more freedom in the rebooted soccer studio since the departure of the old regime, where challenging the orthodoxy had succumbed to crankiness and headline chasing long before its end. Coverage of the national team has been less hysterical but still thorough over the last 12. And I think Damien Duff was talking about it well yesterday after the game as well, about, you know, the expectation of going over there to play for a draw, and, you know, how wrong it seems.
Yeah, I like to see Damien speaking forthrightly now. I think a few of us journalists met him before Euro 2016, before going over to France, and it was his first time to get into that world. And he said, openly, he said, like, I'm not going to criticise Robbie or somebody else because they're my mates and we went through X and Y for years. But now, as you said, it's kind of rebooted, so there's younger players coming in, people he doesn't know, and he's not afraid to give that straightforward answer, which is great to see, because some people can be a bit restricted or constricted by friendships.
There's a sense of loyalty there as well, you know, if you're just out of a camp and then you've got to sit behind a desk. And for sports people, you know, when you're in the arena, you're like, well, what do they know out there? I'm the one here. So when you're on the flip side, it can be hard to do it as well. But I think the best coverage is that bit more objective, bit more realistic sense of it, which we are getting a bit more from the soccer now.
Roy Curtis has a good piece on Connolly as well. I feel it's probably a little overly optimistic and, you know, exciting about somebody who's only played a couple of games. But he's laid it out, like, strong and hard, that he should be involved a bit more. He says, if his omission falls slightly short of a scandal, it was another depressing example of the inherent and suffocating conservatism under which Irish football prefers to operate. McCarthy was celebrating a point won in his post-match interviews, but he was railing against the consensus. And I think I've seen a lot of reactions. Some people were saying, some fans on Twitter saying they'd give up an Irish team being at the Euros to have a team by Kenny. And I think that's a bit too far myself. And we're forgetting the FAI need money as well. That's kind of would be handy. But Kenny's team's playing well, looking good. I mean, their game against Italy, I didn't see it all. But they just go out with that confidence. I mean, if you remember his Dundalk teams, they were just nice to watch because they try, you know.
As you were saying as well earlier on, Cliona, when we started the football chat, you were kind of saying is, you know, the frustration around Mick McCarthy, the fact that we know Stephen Kenny is coming in a year, a bit of time, it could be in 6 months' time, depending on what happens over the qualifying campaign. But is it also down to the fact that on Thursday night, the under-21s go out and play against Italy, and granted it was a nil-all draw, just like yesterday in Tbilisi, but they played well. They took them on, you know.
Yeah, they played well, and the talk afterwards, it wasn't, oh, we were great. You know, there's an ambition. You can feel it off them.
Yeah.
You can see it on the pitch. You can see it in how they play. It's exciting. Mm-hmm. And obviously, as spectators, that's what you want, and it seems that it's bringing the best out of players. And I think when you feel like your national team is settling, or we'll just go there and we'll do our best and we'll defend and we'll hope to nick something at the end, like that doesn't inspire great confidence in you or inspire any sort of, I suppose, enthusiasm about the sport. So I think Kenny seems to be bringing up exciting young players, and also he's enthusiastic and he's drawn the best out of the spectators as well and bringing a bit of energy to Irish football. Well, so why wouldn't you want that?
I think those young players will be much more enthused to play the style of game that Kenny wants to play.
Yeah.
Like, that's his philosophy. You know, earlier on talking about fingerprints, like, Kenny has that way he wants to play. And he gets them to win as well. He gets teams to win. He's had a couple of slip-ups early on, like Dunfermline didn't go so well, but he did well, and he got to a couple of cup finals over in Scotland. Didn't do so well in the league, but he has that ability to get them to play above themselves. I was lucky enough to be at, I don't know if you remember, Derry City Gretna, which doesn't stand out as the all-time European, you know.
I don't remember that fixture, but I remember Gretna, like, as...
You remember Gretna, yeah. Well, one of his...
The quick rise and quick fall.
Yeah, well, his great quote afterwards, they beat them 5-1 in Scotland, and it was just a stunning game of football, amazing goals. And he came in afterwards and said, you know, to the Scottish journalist, said, you all like to think of Gretna as the fairy tale, but we're the real fairy tale. And they went to Stade de France, Parc des Princes, and... I think they drew at home with PSG, you know, a good side.
Yeah.
And the other results he's gotten since coming back, taking Dundalk from where he did. I mean, there's so much there to show a coach who's working. Obviously, you can sign players, but a coach who's working with a lot less than most have. And he's gotten them playing good football, ambitious football. Fans love it. You know, obviously, not everywhere. But the optimism there is that you can get somebody here who's willing to work with players and make them better and create a structure and a style that will be enjoyable for the players and the fans. And that's something we just haven't had. I mean, I was there through all the Trapattoni games for my sins. I don't know what I did in a previous life, but it's something to be a lot more excited about.
But it is like
about.
A breath of fresh air, really.
Oh,
you know,
utterly,
It is more enjoyable.
He's not even here yet. He must be loving this.
Yeah.
Right. We lose 4-0 to Austria in the opening game or something.
Yeah. Right, we are running out of time quite quickly. Where do we want to go before we finish up?
The marathon, maybe?
Yeah. Eliud Kipchoge.
Right away.
Yeah, breaking the 2-hour.
I mean, it's... You can look at it two ways. 2-hour marathon, it's the second time of trying it and does it the other day. Good debate around the science versus the sport, all the different pacing that was used, you know, so they had a car in front of them with a laser to show the pacemakers exactly where to run. You've got new Nike shoes. Some people are calling them, you know, legal doping because they'd knock, I think, 4% or 4% improvement
that,
on it.
That's what some are arguing, yeah.
So, I mean, it's a massive achievement. The way he is presenting it is, you know, showing people that limits can be broken and the power of the human spirit.
It did get a bit, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, wanted to bring peace to the world and stuff. I'm not sure how running the marathon in under 2 hours brings peace to the world, but, you know, for
play
to you did it.
It did just feel
the same time, like, it basically was this massive advertisement for Nike.
And Ineos
as well, yeah. Like, and there's a good piece in the Sunday Times, John Goodbody, on page 11, just details, as you mentioned, how all these factors were set up for him to break the 2 hours. So he says, Vienna was chosen because when an athlete is running at 13 miles an hour, the body temperature goes up. So it was necessary to have a place where the air temperature was around 10 degrees Celsius. The weather in Vienna, with less chance in October of rain and wind, was important. They chose it as well because... it was only, I think, an hour behind Kipchoge's natural body, body clock and stuff like that.
Like talking about logistics.
The pacemakers, the shoes. Yeah. So they have a pair of Nike shoes called the Zoom X Vaporfly Next Percentage, believed to provide a 4% energy saving. Anyone thinking of buying them for their morning jog can expect to pay nearly £300 for the privilege.
Yeah.
Which isn't wildly crazy when you think of some
probably
football,
isn't.
Football boots.
Yeah,
you know,
football boots probably.
But if it again, I do think it's a tough one to quantify. Really, yes, it proves what it proves, that somebody can do that. And if anybody goes into a treadmill today or tomorrow morning, stick it at 21 kilometers an hour.
Yeah,
and see how long you last. Because that's what he's basically
even with
done.
Your shoes. Yeah,
that's what he's done for 2 hours, which is ridiculous. Yeah. Like,
how long do you reckon you could do?
Oh God!
1 kilometers an hour.
Oh, I've no idea. I wouldn't embarrass myself to
you get
suggest.
A 30 seconds.
I'm talking seconds anyway for me. Maybe single digit seconds,
which is insane. Like it's ridiculous. But another interesting thing was that it reminded me that Roger Bannister, when he did his first 4 minute mile, he had pace setters as well, which people probably forget because it was something over 4 minutes. Yeah. I don't know, were they 100 meter runners each one, but. Just a nice mention maybe to finish off, if you're down in Nenagh in Tipperary, there's a statue of Johnny Hayes there, and when they were walking through the history of the marathon, it brought us back to 1908, the Olympic marathon in London, and he did it in 2 hours 55. Now, he was born to Irish parents. He was running for America in the Irish American Athletic Club there, but he did 2 hours 55, and we're now looking at under 2 hours, which is just frankly ridiculous. Mm. And you wonder, you know, what you're going to have to wear something like Oscar Pistorius's
blades
to get much further than this. But I don't quite know what it means. There are a lot of people who are a bit uncomfortable that it is basically a giant Nike ad, especially coming in the week that
the Nike Oregon project is shut down.
Yeah, was it planned?
It's well timed, and even from an athletics point of view.
Is it well timed or badly timed?
Well, I think it changes the conversation a little bit.
It
moves your attention a little bit, and you get to talk about sports science and athletics and the things that are supposed to be good about athletics. This kind of human spirit and human endurance and all that. So it does move a little bit to there.
But it's kind of tapping into the wider cynicism around sport, and you know, it's more of a philosophical topic that, you know, we're not enjoying soccer as much. A lot of people are as we used to because of this overemphasis on sports science and developments. And I mean, it's no surprise Mark Brailsford was involved in that, Mr. Marginal Gains,
or David Brailsford.
Yeah. Sorry, Mark. Whoever.
Sir
you
Dave Brailsford, actually, Kieran.
It's the Republic. It's the Republic, Neil. But a lot of the little details, you know, how they formulated the pattern of the pacemakers. Pacemakers. Sorry, I'm wrong.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of that little detail, and I think a lot of people are finding, and you work in this area, but a lot of people feel there's a lot of the love or the romance of sport and how to get an improvement over somebody else or an edge here. It's almost becoming overkill, you know.
There is so much science around sport, and as a, I suppose, as a field of academia, it has exploded over the last couple of years, which is wonderful for people like me who work in it. You know, people want to know all these stuff. But when you think about what's really good about sport and that competition piece, we always love that human spirit. You talk about Johnny Sexton and doing his roar
Japan
after
this morning.
Japan.
I was just going to tie it all back, yeah.
That's the bit that we find fascinating. That's the bit that brings out the passion. And I suppose the art from a coaching staff is to provide all the good sports science structure, but allow that passion and human element to be expressed within it. You know, that's the magic if you can balance those two pieces.
We're probably going to find a book in about 5 years that says Japan was doing something they shouldn't have been doing, or explain it away in some other scientific way that we're not.
Well, you know, they're able to choose, even small things, they're able to choose the layout of the games they wanted in the pool, you know, when they were playing each team, things like that.
Yeah, they're minor things that Tier 2 nations have always been denied, I suppose.
But at the same time, yeah, exactly. They've had to overcome the stuff that, you know, it doesn't really matter when they were allowed to play Ireland or when they were allowed to play Scotland.
Yeah.
They hadn't really beaten them in World Cups and significant games
before. And they shouldn't be. Yeah. They shouldn't be. But I think to kind of tie it all back up again around the rugby, it would be wonderful now. I mean, this is like when coaches say we've signed a new player, it's like we found a new team. You know, at the elite level of sport, and they play this wonderful, like they're almost like a Brazil of rugby at this stage. I mean, to pull off those results, like they used to maybe play that way, but not get where they wanted. But to do that and to win, and to get through and top the pool, I mean, it's just a dream for them, and it's probably, you know, if we're talking about Nike having a bad week and finishing off with something positive, I think this has finished off the Rugby World Cup's bad week with something positive. What they do next week against South Africa, I think they lost 41-7.
Just a couple of weeks before the tournament started.
Yeah, like you had Mampimpi and Kolbe. But Mampimpi and Kolbe on the wings for them, Matsushima and Fukuoka for the Japanese, like Faf de Klerk and Nagare, the scrum halves are brilliant to watch. It's going to be a fabulous, it's going to be a fabulous weekend. We looked at the four games.
Yeah, unbelievable.
I can't wait for England-Australia. Like Czech and Eddie Jones already close to at each other's throats after
Thursday will be good just with the two of them press conferences.
Exactly, yeah.
And so that's Saturday morning, then the Ireland game, and then two fabulous games on Sunday. Like, I mean, it's a shame we're talking about all the other stuff we're talking about, really, when you look at, you know, how well a lot of the Rugby World Cup has gone and that weekend. It's good to see. I think it's happened in every World Cup that somebody from outside the top eight has gotten to the quarterfinal. So it's great that Japan have continued that.
Yeah.
I think Scotland were normally the team, or Western Samoa, who broke through. I think Scotland were like 10th in about three World Cups, and they got through to the quarterfinal against the pattern, the rankings. So it's great that Japan did it, but they've merited it. That's that's the best thing of all, isn't it? When somebody merits it, plays that way.
They're not lucky, you know. It's they've earned and displayed that they are capable of beating good teams and producing good performances.
Yeah. So. The exact opposite of the Irish soccer team, basically.
That's where I'll leave it. Cliona, Ciarán, thanks a million for joining us this afternoon on the Sunday pay-per-view. That's where we'll leave it for today. We'll be back with the Sunday pay-per-view next weekend at the same time when I expect we're going to be either reviewing a fantastic Irish win in a World Cup quarterfinal for the first time ever, or looking back at another gallant defeat in the last days.
We're looking at a final rematch against Japan. It's all the stars.
Yeah. There's that optimism. Well, you need to talk to Mick McCarthy.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.